This week on the In-Depth Podcast, actor Cheryl Hines.
Oh, yay! Why did we do this? This is ridiculous.
The two-time Emmy nominee reflects on a rough start to her career.
I was like, wow, what am I doing?
Before eventually landing her big break on the hit show Curb Your Enthusiasm.
And I went, that is the best news I've ever heard. And he said, I hope that's not true.
She opens up about her bond with co-star Larry David.
The moment I met him, my life completely changed.
And the emotional farewell to the cast.
It's hard to think that that's not going to happen again.
Plus, Hines reveals how she found levity in the loss of her father.
It was just a weekend of Dad just so angry every time he realized he was still alive.
And discusses her highly publicized marriage to presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
I don't know what's going to happen every day. I don't know what's going to be on the news.
Honestly, one of my favorite tapings we've done in the 14 seasons of the show. Admittedly, when Cheryl was first brought up to me, I only had limited knowledge of who she was. Our team was really pushing for it. And then the more I got into preparing for her, the more intrigued I became. And honestly, after the filming, I think I said this on set, was one of my all-time favorite interviews. She is sweet as can be, has worked her ass off her entire life, has had reason after reason to give up in pursuit of her dream, yet has always stuck with it. And I came away from the conversation thinking that a lot of people could learn from her path to success. So without further ado, Cheryl Hines.
I wanted to start by taking you back to your younger days. How would you describe kind of the living situation when you were a kid growing up?
We didn't have much money growing up. And then my parents got divorced when I was a freshman in high school, and we were living in a two-bedroom apartment, and one of my brothers was in the other room. And so I ended up not only sharing a room with my mom, but sharing a bed with my mom, which was challenging because, you don't have any privacy.
Especially at that age, yeah.
Yeah, we had the phones with the cord, and I'll bring the phone into the bathroom and close the door and try to talk to my boyfriend. And then my mom would be like, I have to get in there. It's like, I'm trying to have a relationship. So it was tough.
So 1983, you were the homecoming queen. And I know you always downplay that, but like, what was responsible for you getting crowned homecoming queen, you think?
Well, I was very involved in high school. I did everything. I was in theater. I was in, played softball for a little while. It was terrible. I was in chorus. I went to every dance. Whatever they were doing, I did it.
And why?
I loved it. Well, I knew I wanted to be an actor, so I knew that very early on. So I was already involved in the theater productions. So yeah, Homecoming Queen, that was a real surprise to me. It was
at the time it was a surprise?
Oh yeah, it was shocking actually.
Really?
Yeah, it was shocking because I went to a pretty big high school. And usually the homecoming queen was, a cheerleader, like a popular person. And I did not feel like that. I mean, I was a cheerleader my freshman year, but I got kicked off the cheerleading squad, yeah.
How does that even happen?
Well, we had citizenship grades as well as academic grades. So your citizenship grades you know, depended on it, what kind of citizen you were in school, which is hilarious. Who came up with this? But if you showed up on time, if you didn't talk during class, I'm not even sure what else it was based on. Those are the two big ones. I was bad at both of them. Like, I talked a lot during class, and I was late to my classes because I had to talk to people in the hallway on the way to my classes. And so then I was put on probation, and they said, look, if you don't bring up your citizenship grades, you're going to get kicked off. And I did try, but there was one teacher that really did not... Listen, I'm saying this now, and I'm hearing myself say it. You know, she didn't like me. But the truth is, I probably did talk a lot during her class when she was trying to teach. And that's not nice.
And you go to cosmetology school. And then I think it's after you get your license, you decide you want to go to college, right?
Yeah.
What kind of changed in your mind after that?
Yeah. Well, when I was in high school, I really didn't try very hard in my classes. It's not what I was focused on. But I knew I wanted to be an actress. So I thought, I will go to beauty school. I'll get my license and I'll cut hair so I can be an actress, so I can pursue that. So I started beauty school when I was 17. And you know, most of the women in there were definitely older, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years older. And at some point I was like, ugh, I don't know if I want to finish beauty school.
Why?
Well, there were things that you have to do. I didn't think through. Like, this woman came in with lice. And I was like, no. I thought, how am I going to go pluck a hair out of this woman's head? I mean, what do I even tell her? I got a strand of hair, and I was like, I'll be right back. And then we looked at it under the microscope, and yes, it had a knit attached to it. I'm like, okay. I did not sign up for knits and lice. And so then my mom is like, no, don't, you cannot quit. Like, finish what you start. But then when I was in cosmetology school, all of my friends were in college. And I would hang out with them all the time. And then I started thinking, oh, are they going to be smarter than me when this is over? Like, what am I missing? Am I missing? Is this huge? Should I be doing this? So I decided, okay, as soon as I'm done with beauty school, I'm going to go to college. So I did. I mean, I after beauty school, I worked in a salon during the day, and I bartended at night, and I saved money to put myself through college. I mean, I'm not proud of this necessarily, but yeah, I tried to get a fake ID using my sister's information at some point in time, and then they knew when I was at the DMV. They said, is that your car out there? And I said, yeah. Because I was so proud because I worked really hard to buy this old car. And they, you know, looked it up, and the title was to me, not to my sister. And they were like, we think that you're Cheryl Hines and you're trying to get a fake ID with your sister's information. And I was like, how dare you? And he said, can I see your real driver's license? And foolishly, I took out my driver's license. I was like, yeah, okay, this is my real one. And he took it and he said, okay, you don't have a license anymore.
Really?
Yeah. And I was shocked. And I said, well, but I have to drive. I mean, I have to go to work. And I had to go to court. And and my stepfather at the time was so sweet because I don't know if anyone asked him to necessarily, but he stood up and sort of gave a grand speech to the people in the room.
What did he say?
He said, because we were trying to see if they would grant me a work license so I could drive to and from work. And he said, this is Cheryl. She's never done anything wrong in her life. I can tell you the only reason she wanted that driver's license so she could go out and dance with her sister and her brothers, and she would never do anything wrong. And I'm like, sit down, Dan. It's too much. Sit down. And then they gave me a work permit, so some sort of license where I could drive to and from work and to and from the grocery store. So I kept a bag of groceries in my car at all times. You know, things that didn't spoil, but just like me in a bag of groceries in case I was ever pulled over for driving to my friend's house.
So you eventually end up graduating school. I think your first job in acting was at Universal Studios.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember from having to perform that, I think it was a shower scene from Psycho, like 15 times a day?
Yeah, what do I remember? Well, it was crazy. It was fun. So I wore a flesh-colored bodysuit, and then they had a shower set that would roll out to the middle of the soundstage, and then they opened the walls, and then they would show how Alfred Hitchcock shot the shower scene, and it was a camera truss with different cameras, and me, and a volunteer from the audience that would act like he was stabbing me with a rubber knife. Yeah, and that's what I did for a few years, but I couldn't have been happier to do it.
But it was motivating.
Very motivating, yeah.
Getting your foot in the door kind of with that, and then there was the swamp thing audition, which I think you tried out for four times,
yeah.
But after the third time, when you just aren't in a good place,
yeah.
You have a conversation with your sister. What does she say to you?
Yeah, I said to my sister, I said, I don't know what to do. I mean, maybe I'm not a good actress. I can't even get cast in Swamp Thing, and I'm so depressed. And she said, yeah, you should probably quit.
And were you really, like, genuinely depressed
yeah.
at that time?
That was Swamp Thing was the only show shooting in Orlando at the time. And it was, you know, I felt like I really needed a role in that.
What are you thinking about when you're in that moment?
I was just tying my self-worth to not getting an acting job. So then it's not just with everything. So, I'm not a good actor. I'm doing everything wrong. You know, you just feel like, what am I doing? And yeah, my sister said, you've chosen a career where most of the things that you audition for, you are not going to get. It's going to be rejection. You've chosen a career of rejection. And if you're going to get so sad every time you don't get an acting job, then you shouldn't do it. That's a terrible life to live. And I, you know, really listened to her, and I thought, oh, she's right. That's going to be a long life. And so then it really switched my way of thinking.
How so?
It helped me understand that the rejection is part of the process. The goal of every audition can't be to get that job, or you're not a good actor, or you're not a good person. So it just shifted. So I was like, oh, right, it's really about being a good actor. And it kind of doesn't matter if you get the job or not.
Well, why did your mom basically say she'll never forgive you unless you move cross country?
Wow, you're really doing this. Okay.
We can skip that.
No, it's sweet to think about it because I haven't thought about it in so long. Well, you know, my mom and my stepfather and anybody who knew me knew that I wanted to move out to LA. And so I had basically sold everything and was ready to go. And then my stepfather, Dan, was diagnosed with liver cancer. So I stayed, and I stayed to be with them, to be with my mom. And then after he passed, she was so sad. And I mean, I was sad as well. So after a while, my mom said, you know, she said, you have to go to Los Angeles, and I'm going to be okay. So I believed her, and I did.
Looking back now, how pivotal was that conversation that she had with you?
It was very, because, you know, when you're young and you lose a parent, that's all you can see for a long time. And so to have my mother say, you're still doing what you said you were going to do and what you've wanted to do, it was a good encouragement, to say the very least, just to remind myself, oh yeah, my life is going on and I should move forward.
Tell about the Toyota Tercel and the notes that your siblings wrote you for the ride.
I'm so close to my siblings. I lost one of my brothers. But so I have two brothers. Well, Chris has passed away, and my sister Becky, Chris, Becky, and Michael. And, you know, it was hard for me to move. It was really hard for me to leave. I didn't have much money. And I was leaving my family. I was leaving everything I loved. And they were so cute and sweet, and they wrote notes to me. And so every day on the road, I got to open one of the notes from one of them. And I have them framed in my office because it meant so much to me at the time. Okay, this is for my sister, Becky. It says, Cher, be safe, happy, and motivated in LA. I'll be seeing you. Okay. I'll be seeing you soon. I can't even read this. Okay. But until then, I'll carry you in my heart, as always. And see your smile and everything beautiful. Travel with the knowledge that I love you as much as anything in the world. And it's for my sister. Oh, yay! Why did we do this? This is ridiculous.
What about that, all these years later, still gets to you?
I mean, because we were pretty young, you know, when she wrote this, and this still captures her. Like, this is who she is. Oof. She, you know, gives me superpowers. Oh, no. Oh, God. Okay, what am I doing? Okay, this is from Chris and April. Oh, no. I haven't read these in so long, and this is going to be hard. Cher, good luck and hope all your dreams come true. We are going to miss you, but you know we'll always be as close as the nearest phone. This will be a good reason for April and I to make it out to LA. We are already halfway there. Remember, you will always be in our hearts. Love, Chris and April. And it's interesting because when I was driving, I couldn't wait till the next day to read the notes.
It's cool that you have them all these years later too.
Yeah, they still stand the test of time. I still need to read it. I'm glad we just read those. It's been a while.
So you make it to LA. You have to make ends meet in addition to pursuing your dreams. Did I read you were a phone operator at one point?
Mm-hmm.
What did like that entail?
Well, okay. I mean, I had two phone operator jobs, if you will. I don't know what my sister told you. One back in the day, they used to have 900 numbers, you know, so for 99 cents a minute, you could talk to someone on different lines. There were sex chats, and then there were also just regular chats. And I worked on a 1-9-9-900 chat. So my name was Cookie. And people would call, I mean, people that wanted to talk to other people, but I guess in their normal lives didn't have a way to do it. So they would call, I would look at a computer screen and a number would light up, you know, from Detroit or something. And I'd say, oh, hi, who's the new caller? It was a conference call, I guess, it's the best way to describe it. And people would talk for hours on these phone lines. And then once in a while, you could put them on a private line together, they would both have to say, yes, I want to do that. And I would have to tell them you're not allowed to have phone sex because that's not what the chat line was about. But they did.
Any memorable conversations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a few. Well, what would happen is when you put them on the private line and you'd say, okay, you guys are not allowed to have phone sex on this line.
You would really have to say that?
Yeah. There were probably three or four monitors that worked in this one little room. And
you're how old?
I was probably 20.
Okay.
And so, and they started having phone sex. We'd say, I got one. And then we'd turn it up so we could all listen in. And before we cut them off, because we had to cut them off at some point. This one time that we were listening, the girl says to the guy, how big are you? And he said, oh, you know, I'm about 6'3". She goes, no, I mean, how big are you? And he goes, oh, I guess about 4 inches. She goes, okay, you're on the phone, you could at least lie about it. So that was one of our monitors. She jumps in, she's like, you're on the phone, you could at least lie about it. And then the two people are like, is somebody listening? Or, I told you we were gonna listen. I told you you're not allowed to have phone sex. And then it just like erupts into everybody's yelling. And the guy is like, it's bigger than 4 inches. I don't know. You know, they're just like, okay, you guys call back on the chat line. You lost your private privileges.
Explain your connection to the O.J. Simpson trial while you're a bartender at the Intercontinental Hotel.
Well, okay, so that hotel is in downtown L.A. And yeah, the O.J. jurors were sequestered at our hotel. And they were on a certain floor, and you weren't allowed to go to that floor. And the jurors were not allowed to, they weren't allowed to read, you know, newspapers or watch TV or anything. And there was one juror, like in their window, they had etched, help me. Because they did not want to be there. They were there for a very long time. My manager had asked me to, this made me feel very important at the time, to pack a bag. Because when the verdict came in, I needed to drive directly to the hotel and check in, so I could just work any job they needed, because they thought it was going to get crazy. And that's what I did. I think that was the first time I stayed in a fancy hotel. I was like, whoa. I'm in a however many star hotel it was. I felt pretty fancy. So yeah, it was interesting.
What did being Robin Michelle Reiner's assistant entail, and how impactful was it for you that they would come to your shows?
Yeah. They were so great to me.
You guys are friends now.
We're friends now. I would, you know, I would do whatever needed to be done. I wasn't giving notes on the movie sets, I can tell you that.
And did not ask him for a job, despite maybe urges to do
right.
So.
Right, you can't do that. Otherwise, who wants who wants an assistant that's always asking for another job and to get you in the business?
That had to be hard, too, because he's really successful in the business, and here you are trying to break in.
Actually, it didn't feel that hard to me because he was in such a different stratosphere than I was. You know, I think it would have been harder if he was maybe a casting director.
The other thing I was told to ask you, and I don't know if there's a story here, a dream you once had with a voice saying,
oh,
you know,
God,
the joke.
That's true. I'm not even sure if it was a dream. I don't know how to describe it, but I was in bed and it was, you know, sort of twilight. I couldn't tell if I was dreaming if I don't know what kind of state I was in. And then I heard there was a man's voice, like a calm, soothing voice in my left ear. And at the time, I wasn't sure what to do next and where I was going to go and what, you know, lane I was going to go down, but still 100% wanted to keep pursuing acting. But there was a voice in my ear that said, you know the joke. And I opened my eyes and I was like, and I didn't move because I wanted to hear more from this. And I never heard anything more after that. And it was just a strange moment in my life.
What about it touches you even recalling it now?
I think about those words and why did I hear those words? You know, and how did I hear those words? But it was very, very interesting to me. And it was calming. And I was like, oh yeah, I do know the joke. Like, you don't have to take everything so personally, so hard. Like, it's all a joke.
And that helped you at the time in making future decisions?
Yeah, at the time I felt like, oh, I think this is a sign to lean into comedy.
I guess you were dating some investment banker at the time, living in a one-bedroom apartment, and kind of have, not like a midlife crisis, but like kind of a reevaluating life goals around that period. Kind of take me to that time and what you're kind of processing.
Yeah, well, when I turned 30, I mean, I was still living in a one-bedroom apartment, rent-controlled one-bedroom apartment in West Hollywood. I was still bartending, and I was like, wow, what am I doing? I'm so far away from my family. I was madly in love with this investment banker who ended up cheating on me. Like, ugh, this is not how I saw things happening. And it was really, you know, a sort of a heartbreaking place. And I talked to my sister. And my sister said, you know, well, why don't you come back to Florida, go back to school and, you know, practice psychology, like be a therapist, because we talked about that before. And I was like, okay. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to keep pursuing my acting. If I'm 75 and still in this one-bedroom apartment in West Hollywood, it's going to be okay because I'm doing what I wanted to do and I find happiness in doing theater work and doing, you know, independent films. And I just decided, you know, it'll just be me. Like, I'm not going to get involved with a child or a pet. Nobody that needs me. If I was broke, I wouldn't but want to be responsible for somebody else sort of living through that, you know.
And your sister said you gained a lot of strength during that period, and you were not so naive after that. as well. In what ways, you think?
Honestly, I was knocked off my feet from that relationship. It was a reminder that sometimes you work really hard and you don't get the thing that you were working for. And that's part of life. It's funny because Bobby, my husband's mom, she must have said this once, Ethel, but it stuck with me. We were talking about something, somebody going through something, and she said, sometimes you just have to take your lumps. I was like, God, I wish you weren't right, but you're right.
Did you feel like then, okay, things just might not work out great for me?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was okay with that. I had great friends. I had a great family. I loved acting. So if those things worked out great for me, then I'm going to be great. You know, anything else that happens will be, you know, icing on the cake. But I have everything. I have a great life.
What did you end up learning while bartending, I think, from the late Phil Hartman's sister?
I was bartending one night, and this woman comes in. She was looking at a map of L.A., and she said, I'm trying to find the Groundlings on Melrose. And I said, what's the Groundlings? And she said, it's this theater. That's where my brother, Phil Hartman, got his start. He was performing there, and somebody from SNL came and discovered him. And I said, oh my God, I need to go to the Groundlings. I watched them and they did sketch comedy and improv. And I was so inspired, and I just couldn't believe what I was watching. And they were also so funny and so smart and so silly. And I knew I needed to be at that theater. Even to be part of the theater, you have to go through their school, and then you have to audition, and at every turn, they could cut you, and most people don't make it. I really wanted to start taking classes there, but I didn't have any money. But that's all I talked about. Anybody that would listen, the other wait staff, the you know, regulars. And for my birthday, they all chipped in and bought my first class at the Groundlings for me. And then my first teacher was Lisa Kudrow.
What was she like?
She was amazing. She's very smart. Very smart and very funny. I just remember watching her thinking, wow, she's so sure of herself. She knows she's silly, but that's what's so great about her. And that's what she's giving, you know? So I watched her and just studied her and was like, wow. And then she was on Friends.
And you had Maya Rudolph, Will Forte, Melissa McCarthy in the class. Do you have kind of best memories from
period? Will Forte, I mean, I have so many good memories. Yeah. Those guys, I mean, my best friends are people that I met at the Groundlings.
You met Rachel.
Rachel Harris, Groundling. Yeah. Yeah. There were times when there was one sketch, there was a girl named Amy Von Freiman. And we were doing this sketch in the main show. I broke and I could not get it together. And then she broke and she couldn't get it together. And then the audience is laughing, which actually will drive any of the directors of the Groundlings insane. Like, they do
really?
Not want you to break. And then this was like kept going until now the audience isn't even laughing anymore. It's like not funny watching these two idiots on stage just like can't get it together. And then they just black out the scene. We never got to finish the scene because clearly we weren't gonna,
right.
It was not ever going to get back on track. And the next night we did the scene. And somebody came in backstage, they said, oh my God, the scene was completely different tonight. We said, no, because we were idiots last night, we could not get it together. And they said, oh, that's the only reason we came to the show tonight. We wanted to see the scene where you guys just laughed the whole time. I said, no, that's not a thing.
You said you were aware enough to watch and learn while at the Groundlings. What do you think being there taught you?
I feel like it taught me everything I need to know about life. Before the first time I was ever on the stage doing our first show, and even though it was just for friends and family, the teacher at the time was Mindy Sterling, and she said, you guys are all good improvisers. If any of you forget any of your lines, don't worry about it. You know what to say. You'll help each other get back on track. And it was like, oh, I can breathe. And she was right, you know, and it would just took so much pressure off. And I think about that all the time when I'm speaking, you know, if you're giving a speech or you're presenting or whatever it is you're doing, it's like, it's helpful with everything, you know.
But it was that realization in that moment that made all the difference to you in terms of how you handle those situations?
Auditioning is really hard. And you never know what you're walking into. You never know who you're meeting. You never know what the room is gonna look like. So just watching the actors before me, watching them so closely, and watching the shows every night was so, it was such a learning process for me, because I would just watch and go, oh, his shoe came off during the sketch. And they didn't freak out. They did this, that, oh, during an improv, you know, somebody from the audience, their phone went off, and then that turned into a thing. And watching what each person is really good at. And that's also part of the process at the Groundlings. People, you start to learn what they're good at and what makes them different. And that was a great gift from the Groundlings. What's the weird thing that happened in your life, or the good thing or the bad thing? And how can you like make that part of who you are and your voice?
Your big break, because of Curb, it almost seemed like you had overnight success. But take me through the, if push came to shove, drinking your own urine, and the role that played in, you know, the big break.
Okay, well, yeah. So when I got Curb, I was in the Groundlings, and I was performing in a sketch show. And Robert Whitey, who produced and was directing this, it just started out as a one-hour special, but they wanted an unknown actress who could improvise. So they were sort of scouting around, and they came, and Robert came to the show that I was doing. And I had written this sketch about a woman in her workplace. She always felt a little like everybody else knows more than she knows. And there's a guy in there doing an earthquake safety seminar, you know, with the group. And my character is feeling like, wow, I don't know any of this. Like, they all know what to do. And they said, what happens in an earthquake if your water supply runs out? And I said, well, if push comes to shove, you can drink your own urine. The guy says, yeah, you can, but also check the water in your water heater, because sometimes there's a supply of water that you can drink first. And I was like, okay. And so in this sketch, my character is just like, you said if push comes to shove. Okay, I thought we were talking about a catastrophe. And so the whole sketch was just this woman like, let it go. That was a whole sketch. And then after that, they called me in to audition for Curb Your Enthusiasm for a one-hour special to improvise with Larry. And then when I walked into the audition, Bob, who had called me and said, oh, it's the urine girl. I was like, mm-hmm, thank you. So that was my introduction.
What do you think caused you guys to hit it off so quickly?
Oh, me and Larry?
Uh-huh.
Something just clicks, mm-hmm. Right? The casting director had said, you've been married, you've got kids, and you don't put up with his bullshit. That's basically all you need to know. And, you know, when Larry talks about it later, he's like, yeah, everybody else came in and was like, you know, go yourself or whatever they want to say, but like really came in hard at Larry. And I guess he just liked that I did it in a way that I still liked him, even though he was an idiot.
So after like the decades of the rejection of, you know, pursuing your craft, describe just the satisfaction of getting that call.
That call was great because they called me later that day and said, I got it.
Which almost never happened.
Almost never happens. But also, it was a 1-hour special on HBO, which was amazing. Did I think it was going to change my life? No. I didn't know how big the part was. It wasn't like, usually as an actor, when you get a script, I mean, I know actors who, that as soon as they get a script, they count every line. But there's no script. I didn't know what it was. But it was the call when they decided to make it into a series. That was the call. That was like, because I was teaching at the Groundlings. I was teaching improv. And on my break, I talked to Larry, and he said, I think we're gonna do the show as a series, and I want you to play my wife. And I went, oh my God, that is the best news I've ever heard. And he said, I hope that's not true. I hope that's not true. I go, why? Can I just have a moment of happiness? Yes, it is true. I'm telling you, this is the best thing I've ever heard. And you know, he made me laugh, and then, yeah. And then that was life-changing, actually. That phone call was life-changing.
You're doing a yard sale at your place on Spalding. You have an interesting conversation when you're haggling over a cordless phone.
I think it was a wallet. This couple comes up and they were like, how much for this? And I said, it's $5. And we talked for a while. And she was like, can I give you $3? And I was like, listen, this is brand new. And it hasn't even been used. I have to really hold firm at $5. And they said, okay. Or we're gonna forget it. And they start walking off, and they turn around and said, we love Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I was like, oh no. I mean, at that point, I didn't even know people were watching the show. Then when I told Larry that story, and he was like, oh my God, how much do I have to pay you to never have another yard sale? He goes, how much did you make at the yard sale? I said, I don't know, $67 or something. He's like, next time you even feel like you want to have a yard sale, let me know and I will give you $67 for you to not have that yard sale.
You remember running into Harrison Ford at the Golden Globes?
I do.
That was kind of a big moment.
That was huge moment. We won, which was crazy. I was walking through a hallway behind the stage, and Harrison Ford and Jeff Goldblum were walking. They were walking this way, I was walking this way, and they stopped and said, hey, congratulations. And I was like, thank you. And he said, I'm Harrison Ford. And he said, I'm Jeff Goldblum. And I said, I'm Cheryl Hines. And Harrison said, yeah, we know who you are. It was just like, oh my God, Harrison Ford and Jeff Goldblum know who I am? That can't be true. But that was like, that was a fun moment.
What about the first few months of shooting Curb made it just so difficult for you?
It was challenging because the first 3 seasons, I never even saw a story outline for the show. So I had no idea what each episode was about. I had no idea what the scene was about. They didn't tell me anything. At some point I said, Larry, can I read the outlines? He said, that's a problem with improv, especially comedians. You tell them this is what the scene is gonna be about, and then they're at home like trying to think of something funny. I said, I promise you, I will not think of something funny. And he finally started letting me read the outlines.
What do you think you learned from being on the show?
Oh my God. Well, I learned everything. I mean, everything from just sort of how to behave as an actor on set, because our set was, we had the best of the best working on Curb, and nobody was, I can't think of a better word than diva. It's not really the right word, but Larry has always set the tone for everybody. And there's just no complaining. Everybody's always grateful to be with each other. I remember one time him saying, actors are always acting like it's so hard. It's not that hard. You're supposed to have a stomach ache, you hold your stomach and you go, oh, my stomach hurts. I was like, well, there is a little more to it than that, but okay.
You said the two of you have a closeness that's hard to describe, and he's in his own category in your life. Explain that, if you don't mind.
I've gone through my life with him, and, you know, we've not only been in this show together, like having fun on set and stuff, but even in a much deeper way, it's been marriages and kids and just a really intimate relationship with somebody.
From what I understand, filming those final episodes were some of the most difficult and emotional experiences of your life. How so?
I've been working on the show for 25 years. And then to try to put into words what Larry has meant to me, because even after the moment after we wrapped, it was kind of quiet and nobody really knew, like, oh, are we all supposed to just walk off the set? Is anybody going to say anything? Larry's not the type of person that's going to say anything. And so I said, you know, I just wanted to thank everybody. And I was just like, oh, I didn't even know how much my life was going to change when I met Larry. Like, the moment I met him, my life completely changed. It's hard to think that that's ending, that's not going to happen again. It's a loss. It feels like a loss.
Really?
Yeah.
And so how do you grieve that loss?
It's like any loss where you know, you don't even know the things that might trigger the emotions of it. Because, you know, sometimes there are times that are normal where you're, it's the last day I'm going to the set or the last time I'm doing whatever. But then you might hear a sound or a noise, or you might drive by that place. Oh my God, that's the place where we spent 3 hours in a car together talking about our kids. And I'm not going to have that moment again with him. You know, sometimes I have to really, like, be grateful for just like anything, right? Grateful for the time that we had together.
You know, you mentioned marriages and kids and, you know, life that happens during the course of the show. I wanted to ask you about marriage. how about, what do you think you learned about yourself going through your first marriage?
That's a good question. I was really surprised at the responsibility that comes with marriage. I don't know why that really took me by surprise. I thought it was going to be the same as being single and dating. Suddenly it just gets kicked up a notch. Then you have a baby and you're like, oh, did you pack the baby's suitcase? Like, did I? Well, I don't know who I thought was going to do it. I did not think it was going to be me. It's just like at every turn, it's like, doctor's appointments. And I'm sure part of it also is just, you know, being an adult. But I don't know. There's like you're suddenly responsible for other people. And maybe because I was single for so long, I never felt like that. I didn't get married till I was 38, I think. So I don't know why that really surprised me.
What made you realize Bobby was the one?
He's extraordinary in every possible way. he is such a joyful person, even though I didn't expect him to be like that. And especially after all the loss that he's experienced in his life, I was just in awe that he still can find happiness and recognize it. He's very unpredictable. I don't know, he's everything.
You mentioned loss, his ex's passing. What do you think going through that taught you guys about the strength of your relationship?
Oh, man. I think, you know, for me and Bobby, we started in a tough place, really, because we, because of the loss of Bobby's wife. So it felt like, well, if we can be there for each other in really hard times, then the easier times should be really great. So, and just to know that you have those bonds and those connections that, once again, you look around sometimes in your life and what you're going through, and you look at the other person, it's like, oh, you and I are the only ones that know how this feels. And we're gonna carry that with us.
How'd he propose?
Oh my God.
I understand it was the limited knowledge I have of it is it was a makeshift ring, right?
We were in Florida, I was visiting my family, and I had my daughter and my niece and nephew, two nephews, and we were out at a river, and Jackson, my nephew, Bobby had said something about how much he was in love with me. And Jackson, who was probably, I don't know how old he was at the time, maybe 8 or 9, and he was said, oh, well, if you love her so much, why don't you marry her? And he's like, okay. And then Bobby gets down on one knee and grabs a piece of moss, puts it around me, and he says, Cheryl, will you marry me? And I was like, what is happening? And they're like, do it, say yes. And I was just like, Bobby, what are you doing? And I said, yes, I would love to. And
had you guys talked about it already
at that point? Okay. No.
Really?
No. I mean, Bobby had, I don't know if he remembers this, because, you know, Bobby talks about the time that he talked to Larry about dating me. There was one time, I think it was after that, he called me to tell me about that. And he said, you know, if everything is true that Larry just said about you, I think I'm gonna have to marry you. I was like, all right, let's settle down. I'm like, let's just take it one day at a time.
So you're now involved in the campaign, at least a little bit. I understand you put some rules in place, at least this is according to some of the articles. You mandated no Steve Bannon show, no communicating with Alex Jones. What are some of the rules that you've put in place?
Besides those?
Yeah.
Listen, we do differ because he will talk to anybody, sit down with anybody, which, you know, is good. But I'm always, you know, I guess if you're running for president, maybe you think about the big picture. Is this helpful to get your message out, whatever you want to get out? I don't know. So I just tell him to try to be a little more thoughtful in that regard.
How receptive is he?
He's very receptive. He's going, you know, 100 miles an hour every day, all day. So it's hard because everybody wants to talk to him. Everybody wants to have him on their show, or sit down, do the podcast, sit down, do the interview.
You have to be like,
yeah,
pause for
yeah,
a
I
sec
wish,
something.
Yeah. But he doesn't always do that.
But when, you know, there's a difference of view, what's the process been like for you in figuring out how to navigate that?
I have to take a step back. I mean, it's true in life, but especially with Bobby and this presidential campaign, like, I can't control things. I can't...
And does that bother you at times that...
It does. It does. I like to do things in a certain way. I can rely on myself. I know that I can navigate and work toward an outcome that I want. But so with Bobby and what he's going through, there's no way I can work towards an outcome that I want. I don't know what's going to happen every day. I don't know what's going to be on the news. I don't know what's going to be on Twitter. There's nothing I can do about it. And even if I sit around all day and hope, oh my God, I hope this thing happens, or people see it this way, or Bobby says it that way, it doesn't matter. It's not helpful. So I have to keep letting go.
I was talking to your other friend, Suzanne, and she brought up that I needed to ask you about the lighthearted moments surrounding your dad's passing. And I, when she said that, I had to ask her to repeat herself, but that is a thing.
Well, my dad, okay, was a character. And at some point, he had a heart attack. He went into the hospital, and it was clear that he was not going to make it. And, you know, they said, Cheryl, you need to come out here because we're going to, you know, stop doing this one thing that was really keeping him alive. And so my two brothers and my sister and I, we were there in the hospital room, and we're around the bed. And we're like, Dad, I love you so much. And, you know, we thought within hours it would, well, at that point we thought within minutes that we were like, okay, we all love you. And he said, thank you. And we're sitting there and time is ticking by and it's like, okay, I don't know how long we're gonna sit here, okay. And now it's like hours. And then at some point, we're all just kind of like nodding off. And then my dad opens his eyes and he's like, he said, why am I the only one with my goddamn eyes open? When is this supposed to happen? And we're like, oh my God. And he goes, I'm ready to go. And we're like, no, we're here. It's like, all right. And then he'd close his eyes and then we're all like, okay. And now, now a day has gone by. And now it's the next day. And we're watching the thing go up and down. And then we're like, let's just go sit in the waiting area for a second and just like regroup. Like he's ready to go, and the nurse was like, this is good, because sometimes people need to be alone, and so we're in there for hours, and then at some point the nurse says, you guys, if you want to come back in and say your final goodbyes, because I think this is really it. And we're like, okay, we kind of have said it all, but we'll go back in. We go back in, and Dad, we love you. And then, you know, he closes his eyes, and then it's like, and he's like, damn it. We're like, still hanging in there, Dad. And it was just a weekend of Dad just trying to pass peacefully and so angry every time he realized he was still alive. We were just like, what is happening? So it was an interesting moment in life and death that he did pass. And it was, you know, an experience that we all shared, but just his anger was hilarious.
What do you think you learned from each of your parents?
Well, my dad was funny. He was a bit of a dreamer.
How so?
He always had an idea. Well, for instance, one year he bought a van and like three mopeds. And I'm not sure exactly what the plan was, but somehow that was going to turn into a huge business. It didn't. He did not seem to sweat the big things, which sometimes need a little sweat. But I like that he was always up for a good time and like enjoyed the people around him and really, you know, just didn't expect too much. My mom, oh my God, my mom's, she likes to have fun. And she'll tell me ridiculous things like, now, when you walk into the party, frame yourself in the doorway and wait till everyone takes you in. And then just drop your sweater so they can take in your dress and then enter the room. It's like, okay. But she likes to, she's a good time. She has a good time.
I wanted to ask you about your nephew and cerebral palsy and what you've done kind of on the philanthropic front. But would you be okay if I ask you a couple questions about Chris?
Yeah.
He passed unexpectedly in his 50s of a heart attack, but your sister had said that he was the lightning bolt for our family, absorbed all the trauma, got all the bad breaks. Your thoughts on that?
No, she's right. He was always the strong one. And then his son, Michael, my nephew, was born with cerebral palsy, and that was so challenging, and he really had to be strong for Michael. I mean, strong in every way.
Because he was a primary caregiver.
He can't control any of his muscles. He can't do it. He really can't do anything for himself.
And almost nonverbal.
Yeah, it's limited. So Chris, when he had Michael, he was just like, okay, this is what my life is. It's like, you know, the deadlift of picking him up and getting him ready for school and washing him, cleaning him, feeding him. Just every moment of Michael's life depended on what Chris did.
Becky said with Chris's passing, you probably had it harder than anyone because you were away. You kind of never felt more alone during that period. Any truth to that?
Yeah, it was really hard. I definitely felt like I'm so far away from them, living in Los Angeles, and it's hard because even when I first moved out here, there was a loneliness because my family has always been my backbone. But there's something about grieving with other people. There's a connection to it that makes it sometimes more bearable, maybe.
You were quoted as saying, like, you didn't know if you would make it.
Yeah.
How did you get through, you know, whatever that tough period was?
I read books, which is as if it were only that easy. Because I kept thinking, when does it get better? Like, I just need to know when it gets better because I can't even imagine it. I can't even imagine feeling happy. But when you read it and someone else has been through it enough and understands it enough to be able to write it, you know, just that if you feel like you can't do anything right now, you can't get out of bed, you can't make a decision, then you shouldn't, because you are experiencing grief and that's where you're going to be for a while. And it's like, that was helpful, even though it's not what you want to hear. I wanted to hear, you know, on day 26, you're going to wake up and feel a little bit better. There's not a moment, but there will be. And for me, it was helpful because of Bobby, because Bobby has lost two brothers and his dad. So I know that he's been through this sort of grief. And I remember asking him, like, oh, when does it feel better? And he didn't give me an answer. And I was like, ugh, it's that bad. But I was glad that he didn't, because there's nothing that you can say. It's just like, it's walking through the fire. You're just gonna have to walk through it.
How special has it been, what you've had the opportunity to do with Michael and cerebral palsy on the philanthropic front?
My nephew Michael is very inspirational. It's been amazing working with all of the people at UCP, you know, different families with children with cerebral palsy or any other type of disorder or something that needs special attention, kids that need special attention. So just knowing that there are people you can talk to, people at UCP, parents can go in and say, oh, I don't even know where to begin. They'll say, oh, we do, we can help you. You know, for people to hear that is life-saving.
Tell about the cold call you made right after, you know, kind of understanding Michael's situation.
I didn't know anything about cerebral palsy. I didn't know anything about it. And I was living out here, and I just looked up United Cerebral Palsy because it has cerebral palsy in the title. I was like, they must know something about it. And I drove to the local UCP chapter here, and I sat down and talked to them, and they said, okay, let's get you guys going in Orlando, and I'm going to introduce you to somebody over there.
And what happened from there?
We, like, toured around the UCP, you know, school for kids, and they can help you identify exactly what kind of needs that person has and how they can help and how they can mobilize them, how they can teach them, how they can, you know, do different types of therapies. So it was just like, it felt hopeful, you know? It's like, oh, okay.
And give a little more color to this event that you guys put on, typically in the spring, yeah.
Well, every year I think it's usually in April, UCP does a big gala. And I've been hosting it, I don't even know how many years, 18 years or something like that. And now Rachel Harris does it with me. And when we started, we would do a poker game the night before, just because I was in town and we would all play. And somehow the poker game started growing and growing. So now it's a poker game the night before and a gala the next night. And they raise like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we just have a really fun time. And it's usually silly and fun.
Thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. This is like therapy. I know people must say that all the time.
Sorry for
No, in a good questions. Way. No, it's good. It's really amazing.
And anything I did not ask that you would have liked to cover?
No, I think you covered it all.
Hope you enjoyed my chat with Cheryl Hines. We also had the opportunity to talk with Cheryl and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. together in L.A. We spoke about everything from a pet emu to Bobby's presidential campaign. Look out for that interview on Wednesday. And to watch all video clips of our time with Cheryl, head to youtube.com/GrahamBensinger. Please remember to give us a rating and review. And thanks again for listening.